One of the things I love about feminist theology is, like, there isn't one thing. There are as many feminist theologies as there are people doing feminist theology. And I really love the kind of messiness of that. But also, I think partly because patriarchy across theology and across our scriptures is so dominant and so kind of woven all the way through it, that actually feminist theology is the kind of thing that recognizes patriarchy in all those places and acts to challenge it, acts to reveal it even. Sometimes revealing it is all that the feminist theologian can do, but that in itself is a good thing.
Hi, I'm Brandon Nappy.
Hi, I'm Hannah Black.
And we're your hosts on The Leader's Way, an audio pilgrimage from Berkeley Divinity School, the Episcopal Seminary at Yale University.
On this journey, we reflect on what matters most in life as we talk about all things spirituality, innovation, leadership, and transformation. So, Brandon, we are back in Connecticut from Texas.
We are, and it's true. Everything is bigger in Texas. So we were in a hotel, a conference center right on this mall, which was maybe as big as 10 malls that I've ever been in.
Well, first of all, how were there two of the same hotel within one mall? Wow. And also, it made it feel like it was a city unto itself. Like, you could eat there, you could sleep there, you could shop there. It didn't have a church inside the mall.
Well, I guess we were providing the church, weren't we?
That's true. There was worship every morning.
Still recovering. We had this amazing time. So many beautiful, wonderful leaders from all around the country within the Episcopal Church just kind of coming together and having a little bit of a family reunion, I think is how I would most name it. We were doing some thinking and some reflecting, but it was a little bit like a love fest.
It was a little bit like a love fest. So we were there for Episcopal Parish Network Conference, EPN, and I think that was the first time I was in one place with 800 Episcopalians. And so you start to, like, get to know the subculture a little bit better. And I think just, like, spot on what I would have expected, which was a lot of hope, a lot of love, a lot of wanting to do great things for the kingdom of heaven and seek justice and a lot of good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been to a lot of conferences in my life. And just shout out to the planners of EPN. I just feel like this was one of the more human kinds of conferences. Like, there wasn't a lot of armor up and posturing. Yeah. And let me tell you about how brilliant and wonderful and smart I am. Like, it was just a lot of friendship.
Yeah.
Which is, like, even post-pandemic, which I still feel like in some ways we're in, I still need that. Like, humans connecting with other humans in the same room.
And, I mean, our listeners deserve to know that upon the recommendation of one of our board members, Brandon and I hopped on Ticketmaster, got tickets, and on a whim went to the Houston Rodeo.
Let me just say that I do nothing spontaneously in my life. I am a planner.
Really?
I'm not advocating this approach, but it is like I can tell you what I'm doing 3 months on a Thursday afternoon. We very spontaneously went to the rodeo. And I'll be thinking about it for a very long time.
I consider myself well-traveled. I just lived internationally for a while. And it feels kind of rare to me that I go to something and think, wow, I have no idea what's about to happen next. This is so, like, it felt so foreign, but also so not foreign. I was like, okay, this has a little bit of county fair, a little bit of, like, sports game, a little bit of, like, going to a concert, a little bit, like, amusement park, food and wine festival, like, just all those things rolled into one.
Can I throw in another one? A little bit like horror movie.
What?
Because, and just hear me out. There was so much suspense. Like, is that person gonna die, fall off the bowl, and be trampled? I was anxious. I'm an anxious.
You were having some visceral reactions.
Visceral, like I was like keeling over. Danger. Like, I so care about these
that element of danger.
Danger. Yeah. And so like I needed a nap afterward. It was exhausting. Even, you know, I did nothing but eat a funnel cake and watch, but I was exhausted.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about what we ate because we were excited about that. First of all, there were so many things to choose from. And being a Californian, I thought I need Mexican food because that's just a thought I have always. But we decided when in Rome, when in Houston, and we went with the brisket sandwiches.
We did.
And then some funnel cake for Brandon. I went for the fried Oreos because Oreos remind me of being a teenager in church and having Oreos at small group Bible study. So that's sweet. But also they were way better than I ever would have thought.
Yeah, I'm going to call that Oreo experience, and you were kind enough to let me have one. I'm going to call them the Eighth Sacrament.
Whoa.
They really exceeded my expectations.
I know. Well, because the thing is, I think what I was picturing was like a crusty fried situation, but it was more like a beignet with a surprise Oreo inside. The Oreo like lost its structural integrity somewhere in the process in a really good way.
In a good way. I was also really touched. I mean, there were hundreds of livestock and cows. And I just remember seeing like these teenagers like caring for their cows in a way that was just really sweet.
I will say many things melted my heart. The quilts melted my heart. The children's art melted my heart. And then I wouldn't consider it a heart melt. It was emotional, but I don't know what the emotion was. Witnessing mutton busting for the first time.
We may need a whole mutton busting episode. There are so many questions. So many ethical quandaries. It was amazing. Yeah.
So for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the sport of mutton busting, these children who are about 6 years old grab onto the back of a sheep. And then, I don't know, they tell the sheep, go. And the sheep just starts booking it to the other side. So the sheep is sprinting. And the child, who's about 6 years old and wearing a helmet, their job is to hold on for as long as they can. And then they fall off. It's like surfing, I guess.
Right. And, you know, depending on the kid, this experience is the most incredible, life-giving ecstasy ever. Or
they pull them up by their clothes. The camera zoomed into their face and they look like they've just fallen off a sheep at high speed.
So we learned a lot. I'm really thankful for it. Still processing. It was clear that we were not from there.
Yeah.
We didn't have a cowboy hat. We didn't have cowboy boots.
No.
And finally, I think one of my most important takeaways is that we need more Connecticut-shaped food. Like when you go to Texas, you can get a variety of different foods, all shaped like Texas.
In the shape of Texas.
Cookies, French toast, pancakes. I don't know that here in Connecticut we make any food shaped like Connecticut. So that was a huge takeaway for me. So we actually have a podcast episode, don't we?
For today? It's not just going to be us talking about the rodeo today.
I mean, we could.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I have been really excited about this one. Today, we're talking with Karen O'Donnell, who's academic dean and lecturer in worship and human community at Westcott House in Cambridge, the United Kingdom, Cambridge. And Karen teaches Introduction to Christian Worship, Patterns in Christian Worship, and she teaches the MPhil exercise in Religion and Gender at Cambridge. So her story is after a career as a secondary school teacher, she undertook postgraduate study in theology, and her doctoral thesis focused on trauma and the Eucharist and relationship to bodies. And she was the leader of the MA program in Christian spirituality at Sarum College before she came to Westcott. The reason I know Karen is because she recently launched an online community called the Feminist Theology Gathering, which is mainly a WhatsApp community. It's also, you can get on the email list. And I've been helping Karen with some of the programming. We have some really exciting talks coming up that people Zoom into. It's a little bit of a shame because I left Cambridge right as Karen was coming to Cambridge. And we have so many academic interests in common. So we've been sort of working on feminist theology together from afar. Her book is called Broken Bodies, the Eucharist, Mary, and the Body in Trauma Theology. She has another book that I believe is coming out this summer, so we'll look forward to that. It's super exciting and sparkly for me to have Karen here on the podcast to talk about feminist theology. And I'm hoping for our listeners who haven't had a lot of exposure to feminist theology that this is a fun window into it.
Yeah, I found this a really powerful conversation, especially just this core insight, which maybe if you haven't done a lot of reading in feminist theology, you might not realize, but patriarchy hurts everyone and feminist theology helps to liberate everyone, right? So so there's a really expansive vision here for all of humanity. It's not just for women. It's not just focused on women's issues. Women's issues are human issues. They belong to all of us. So I love this sort of expansive place that she invites us to.
Welcome, Karen, to the Leader's Way podcast. I'm so excited that we finally get to record together. This is just wonderful.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's really great to be here.
Yay.
There's so many Cambridge vibes going on right now. I'm wondering, does Cambridge have a mascot?
No.
I don't know. I have no
idea.
They
don't really have mascots in the UK.
No.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Except for like Hogwarts has some mascots internal to Hogwarts.
It's a gesture of grace towards our American readers.
Thank you.
All.
Yeah. Just translating. I need things in animals.
The Cambridge love is abounding, so I'm just going to bask in your light.
Well, Westcott has a tortoise, right?
We do. We have Hort the tortoise, who's over 100 years old, named after one of the previous bishops. He now makes a very gentle appearance in the final weeks of the Easter term. And technically, the senior student is supposed to be responsible for Hort when Hort is here. No senior student wants Hort to die on their watch. So it becomes a very stressful couple of weeks. But he just roams the garden. They kind of give his shell a little bit of a wash. You give him some water. He likes to munch the grass. He's super cute. Yeah.
I think if I'm successful in life, whatever that means for me, someone might name a tortoise after me one day.
And you've really made it.
That's a really high bar.
Right?
Wow. Okay.
It seems less high than naming a person after you.
Also, like, Hort's lived, you know, he's lived 100 years. I mean, that's longevity.
He's seen things.
Right?
Yeah.
Seen ordnance come and go.
Yeah. World events.
Uh-huh.
Sort of a passive dude for, you know, having seen so much. But
hibernates for like 10 months of a year.
Totally. Maybe that's the secret, honestly. So one of the reasons I wanted to ask you onto the podcast is because in a previous episode, I mean, I can't help myself. I just pepper in little feminist theology thoughts. Yeah. But I thought to myself, we really need to have a guest who can kind of give our listeners a little intro to what feminist theology is. I immediately thought of you because you've recently launched this online feminist theology network that's really exciting. And a lot of people have expressed interest in it. It's become a digital community that's really wonderful. So with that interest and that in my mind makes you the queen of feminist theology. So I was wondering.
I'm terrified and also very, very happy about that title. I will take it. And also I fear it.
Yeah, that's fair. So as queen of feminist theology, might you be able to kind of give our listeners a little intro? What is feminist theology?
So I think sometimes people think feminist theology is just like women doing theology.
Yeah.
And like, that's a good thing. Women should be doing theology, but that's not quite enough. And I think sometimes people think feminist theology is just like when we bring the feminine in alongside the masculine, but and that's good, like we should do that, but that also isn't necessarily kind of sufficient. It's kind of sometimes just serving to uphold like dominant gender paradigms that are already like very well established in theology. So I like Rosemary Radford Reuther on this. If any of your listeners have not read Rosemary Radford Reuther, you must. She is the queen of feminist theology.
True.
Or was the queen.
You could be the princess, I guess.
I take that, yeah. So Radford Reuther says, if you'll forgive a quote, she says, feminism is a critical stance that challenges the patriarchal gender paradigm that associates males with human characteristics defined as superior and dominant, like rationality and power, and females with those defined as inferior and auxiliary, such as intuition and passivity. I find that super helpful for then thinking about what feminist theology is. So I would usually talk about feminist theology as theology that is seeking to kind of question in a really wide range of quite creative ways the kind of patterns and modes of theology that really justify and perpetuate forms of male dominant and female subordination kind of paradigms. And really recognizing that patriarchy is bad for everybody, not just for women. Like patriarchy pushes men into roles in the same way it pushes women into roles, and none of those are helpful things. So feminist theology for me is like theology that's trying to push at that. Mm. One of the things I love about feminist theology is like there isn't one thing. There are as many feminist theologies as there are people doing feminist theology. And I really love the kind of messiness of that. But also I think partly because patriarchy across theology and across our scriptures is so dominant and so kind of woven all the way through it, that actually feminist theology is the kind of thing that recognizes patriarchy in all those places and acts to challenge it, acts to reveal it even. Sometimes revealing it is all that the feminist theologian can do, but that in itself is a good thing. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Yeah, I'm thinking, can you transport us to your classroom? And what are those conversations like? You use the word messy. And I mean, learning is so messy. Life is messy. Growth is messy.
Yeah.
And what's it like to have a front row seat to students? I imagine some of them coming into contact with feminist theology for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, what are the surprises for you as a teacher? Where do your students typically get stuck? Where are the arguments and the wrestling? Take us into a class with you.
Yeah. So I actually taught a fantastic class this morning. Like, I enjoyed it so much. I'm pretty sure the students enjoyed it. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. But I had a revelation this week where I discovered that one of my first year students who already has a theology degree, and he's now an ordinand studying a master's qualification. So he's come in from a very good university with a very good degree. And I'm teaching a class on liturgical theology of the Eucharist. And I set a piece of writing by Teresa Berger to read. He was reading it in the library, and one of the other classmates came over and was like, oh, Berger's really cool. And it turned out that's the first piece of feminist theology he'd ever read. And he has a first class degree from one of the UK leading institutions. I was like, how is that possible?
Yeah.
And we can talk about that later on. But so one of my kind of ways of teaching feminist theology is that every class that I do is a feminist theology class, regardless of the subject that I'm teaching. So I'm teaching this class on liturgical theology of the Eucharist. It's awesome. I'm really enjoying it. We're reading queer theology in it. We're reading feminist theology in it. We're reading Black theology in it as part of the course. So I'm wanting them to come out as well-rounded theologians at the end of it. How can I do that if I'm only giving them dead white men to read? And liturgical theology, right? It's harder. Like, it's a challenge for me to think, right, hang on a minute. Who am I setting to read? Whose voices am I amplifying in the classroom? And generally, I think in those contexts, students kind of respond to that pretty well. Mm-hmm. So class I taught today was on Trinity and gender, and it's an MPhil class. So some of my students in there are ordinands, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. And it's a master's class, but actually a whole bunch of my PhD students like just kind of turn up because it's a really great class. So we were reading Julian of Norwich and Janet Martin Soskis. Fantastic. And yeah, where things get tricky, often teaching in a confessional context where people often do want to hold on to some kind of sexed distinction between male and female and find the idea of gender as something socially constructed rather than God-given to be challenging, like not insurmountable, but if you've never encountered that before and you're in your kind of mid-20s, early 30s, that's a big thing to kind of come across and have disrupt your kind of way of thinking. So sometimes people get stuck there. There's some perennial kind of questions, you know, is it useful to use feminine language for God? Is something we were talking about today as a strategy for thinking through the masculine nature of the Trinity and the way in which, you know, if God is male, then the male is God. Interestingly, what I have found is that this is the second year I've taught that class. It's mostly women that take it. In fact, almost exclusively. It doesn't have to be. It's open for everybody. I find that's problematic, and it's easy for people to opt out of learning because they see something as, they see feminist theology as something that women do. They see it as something that's dangerous and not proper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, I've digressed. Anyway, back to my classroom. Actually, most of the students I've encountered tend to be pretty open. There are kind of points of conflict, and sometimes that's about, you know, where the trans women are really women. You know, we've been reading this year Susanna Cornwell's Transgender Theology, which has been fantastic, but it's really provocative and requires people to think through what it might mean to understand God as a being in whom gender is both non-existent and also in excess. And so, yeah, we've been kind of wrestling with apophaticism a lot. It's rich and generally well-received. And yeah, the places where people get stuck are not insurmountable, but just often just really new.
Yeah, kind of paradigm blasting.
yeah. And something that's really sad, right? Like, feminist theology isn't taught enough. I didn't do any feminist theology until I was a PhD student. In fact, I did an entire undergraduate degree without ever reading any women, not even feminist theology. I just didn't read any women.
Yeah, I encountered feminist theology in my PhD as well. I have to have read some. I read Julian, et cetera.
But okay, yeah.
Anyone who was sort of a feminist theologian was like, ooh, don't let your friends see you checking that out.
And, you know, it was 20 years ago, but women were doing theology 20 years ago. They just weren't on my reading list as an undergrad. Yeah.
Well, and you and I both have been told pretty explicitly just not to do feminist theology and or Absolutely. Not to call it feminist theology. So there's a very real dynamic at play there too.
When I was a master's student and I was applying for PhD funding, and what I wanted to do wasn't explicitly feminist because I hadn't actually ever really kind of read any feminist stuff, but it was about Mary, about the Virgin Mary. And a very senior female theologian, a UK theologian, said to me, look, Karen, if you want to be taken seriously as an academic, you need to stop doing all that woman stuff.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I was quite bullish and I was like, nah, pretty happy with what I'm doing, kind of cracked on. But yeah, I've never forgotten it. And I know what she means, right? Actually.
Yeah, totally.
There are faculties that would not employ me because I specialize in feminist theology.
Well, I'll make the confession that I made earlier to you, Hannah, as an undergrad theology student. I think I had a choice of taking an Augustine class that was going to put me in the classroom at, 8 o'clock on a Friday morning, or I could take this feminist theology class, which, you know, I think it met once a week for like 3.5 hours, and then I could have my Friday free. And I was like, well, done. Right. So I took the feminist theology class because I could, go out on Thursday nights and sleep in on Friday. And this class changed my life. So this is with Catherine Lacunia, the Trinitarian scholar, who actually died of cancer in the middle of our class while we were reading her book, God With Us, the sort of groundbreaking.
She's our text for next week. We're reading.
Oh my gosh, Catherine Lacunia. Oh, yeah. Tender heart. Oh. So patient with, at least for me, I'll speak for myself. It took me the semester to catch up.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I mean, this is 1996. And I'm just so thankful both for the kind of urgency that she had around this work. It was needed yesterday, and her utter generosity of patience as I was just sort of grappling with new language. And, we swim in the patriarchy. So we're fish in water. What do you mean water?
We don't see it. Exactly.
We don't see it.
Yeah.
So
amazing.
Would you say a word about Mary? I feel like if you want to start a fight in theology, you start saying things about Mary. So what kinds of fights have you been having?
Oh, do you know, I haven't had that many fights, but maybe I just don't talk about her enough. Like nobody ever asks me to teach a class on Mary. So maybe it's not needed here. I don't know. Oh, so I can't escape her. Every time I think I'm done with her, she pitches back up again. when I went off to do my PhD, I thought I was going to be a Mariologist. And then like 3 months into my PhD, I discovered trauma theology. And I was like, that's me. I'm sold. so I kind of never escaped Mary, but my kind of dominant interest kind of went elsewhere. I've just finished editing a book on pregnancy and theology, which will be out in July. Small plug there. We're very excited. I edited it with Claire Williams. We've herded cats for 2 years. We now have this amazing volume. And I put in a little bit of it was actually a bit that my Viva examiners in my PhD told me to take out of the PhD. And I loved it so much, I've never let it go. So I put in this chapter that's on called Pregnancy, Human and Divine. And it's about the relationship between Mary's flesh and the body of Christ, and the difference between Mary's pregnancy and other pregnancies, and whether or not we can then take Mary's pregnancy as a model for human pregnancy in general. Spoiler, no, we can't. So yeah, that's, I've kind of put that in there. I'm really interested to see what people make of it because it's quite biological. So talking a lot about like mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondrial DNA for women is passed down and it's lost for men. So there's this kind of, in Jesus's body, a kind of legacy of women, but because there's no male sperm, is missing the legacy of men that he would normally get. So I just like, oh, I'm super fascinated by that. Like, I'm sure the biologists would be like, that's not how it works, Karen. But I did my best with the sciences. So I've done that one. Another thing I wrote recently was about Mary the crone, where I've been thinking about Mary after the resurrection, because in kind of apocryphal and early Christian texts, you know, she lives until she's in her 80s. And so I've used this text called The Life of the Virgin by Maximus the Confessor, which talks about Mary, the kind of life of Mary beyond Jesus' ascension, where she's a leader in that she teaches them how to preach and she teaches them how to pray and she teaches them what Jesus is like. And, you know, she tries to leave Jerusalem and kind of let the church community grow. And she's kind of turned back and sent back by God into the community and made to kind of stay there. And I've drawn that into conversation with Nicholas Slee's work on, she has a little book called The Book of Mary. And Nicholas Slee has this amazing poem about Pentecost, and it's the older Mary, Mary the crone, who sat with the children in the church, and the Spirit begins to move and Mary's eyes light up because she's been there before, and she tells the children about Pentecost. Oh, just love it. So I try not to get in many fights with it. I know she's a bit contentious for feminist theologians. I think there's much to be gained from creative reflection with Mary. And I really appreciate it, like theologically and like for my own kind of spirituality as well.
Yeah, it may be that I'm just being shaped by a conversation that I had just yesterday with Teresa Berger, in fact, and the Roman Catholic students who are gathering to plan the Feast of the Annunciation service in Marquand Chapel.
Yeah.
Right? And so how sort of Mary forward do we want to be? How sort of Roman Catholic do we want to show up in a traditionally reformed chapel space? So it's all on the mind.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, we wrestle with that here, right? We're, Westcott House is an Anglican theological college. And whilst it might once have had a very kind of Anglo-Catholic tradition, it doesn't really have that. It's much more varied now. And we have, you know, some students who are big fans of the BVM and some who are like, she is not important to me at all. I will happily sing a song at Advent about her, but other than that, I'm not really bothered. It's always really interesting.
Wow. So how did feminist theology become important to you? Was it through Mary? Was it a different way?
Well, I spent 15 years from being about age of 14 in a charismatic evangelical church that I got kind of converted and saved into that was strongly complementarian. And I can look back now and see that I was profoundly shaped by narratives that I heard at the front of the church, the visuals that I saw of who could be in leadership, who could preach, but also as a teenage girl, the kind of models of marriage and relationship that I saw. You know, my youth leader got married at 18. She didn't kiss her husband until they got like, I now pronounce you man and wife. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And I was like, oh, right. Okay. That's what I should do. That's not what happened. but you can't see me on the podcast doing my little aside into my hand. But anyway, like there was no women in leadership except for children's work, which is totally okay. So there was this expectation of marriage. I got married at 22. I was an old maid.
Right.
So wrong. And that you produce babies. You know, that was the job. And when you started producing babies, you go down to part-time work. Or you might stop working altogether. That was appropriate. And I've written widely about my experiences of multiple pregnancy losses during that time, which eventually led to the breakdown of my marriage, but also leaving the church. Church did not know what to do with me as somebody that couldn't fulfill that.
Yeah, you weren't fitting in role that box.
I didn't fit. Yeah, and they just didn't know what to do with me. Well, so that was awful, like really good things came out of it. And I was a secondary school teacher, so I quit my job and went and enrolled on a master's degree and then was really fortunate and got some PhD funding and went off and did my PhD. I'd started to think about Mary. I couldn't even tell you why, but in my master's at Nottingham, and Mary Cunningham, who's an Orthodox nun, I think, she's amazing. She taught this class on Mary. I was the only person in it. So me and Mary sat and talked about Mary 2 hours every week. It was so cool. And I can't even remember why I picked it beyond the fact that I quite like Mary Cunningham. And I was like, well, this sounds cool. I'd enjoy it. And there wasn't much on the curriculum that was about women. So my 20th century theology was Karl Barth, Karl Rahner, and Hans Urs von Balthasar. That was it. Right? I did that. I did Dante. Uh-huh. And I did Henri de Lubac. And then I did Mary. That was my other thing. And then I ended up doing my dissertation at Mary as well. So I kind of started getting into Mary. And then that kind of led to the PhD proposal. And I was quite anxious about term feminist. I didn't identify as a feminist. I was quite anxious about feminist theologians. I pitched up in my first PhD supervision with Siobhan Garrigan. And I was like, I'm quite anxious about feminist theologians. I don't really think they've got anything to say to my project. And she told me to get a grip and sent me away to read a whole load of feminist theologians. And she was quite right. So I read Rosemary Redford Ruther, and I read Beth Johnson, and I read Dolores Williams and Sabine Jones and Nicholas Slee and Kelly Brown Douglas, and just discovered this whole world that I knew I loved theology, but I did not know theology could be like that. I didn't know it could be so creative and so liberative. And that was so attractive to me. It was a way of kind of holding on to all of the good things that I really appreciated about the Christian tradition, whilst, I guess, really recognizing that theology is a human endeavor and that therefore it can be wrong, and that there is space within theology to kind of reclaim and reshape the goods of the Christian tradition that kind of do better justice to our attempts to speak about God. And I had never encountered that before. So it gave me hope, I think, having come out of what I could kind of at that point reflect back on a church experience that had been incredibly damaging. It gave me hope that things could be better and started to help me articulate who I was and what my faith looked like. So for me, my experience of academic study has always been intertwined with my own faith experience, my own kind of spirituality. So I often joke that I became an Anglican because of my PhD. Like I pitched up in Exeter Cathedral, and then before you knew it, I was being received into the church, and bish bash bosh, now I'm academic dean at an Anglican Theological College. So doesn't take long. But I would say, oh my goodness, it genuinely changed my life. And more than that, it changed my relationship with God. And therefore, it changed the kind of theology that I felt I'm able to produce out of my own body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, oh my goodness, this has been quite the journey over the last decade for me.
Yeah.
Zero to, you know, heading up a network of feminist theology.
Totally.
It's worldwide and really exciting.
Which is just like taken on a life of its own.
Amazing.
So quickly.
Yeah.
So I have a group of students right now who are really struggling to see the link between the study of academic theology and their call to ministry. And I have a very similar experience to yours, which is that my spiritual life has more often than not been fueled by my theologizing. But I completely see where they're coming from. And it's a really common struggle for people studying theology to have trouble in their spiritual lives in tandem. What kind of words do you have for people in that position who are kind of studying academic theology, wondering what the point is, but really have a heart for the church, that kind of a thing?
Yeah. So we actually, at the start of the academic year, not this year, but last year, with one of my colleagues, we ran a session for all our returning students. And we used Simone Weil's work on attention and attention and its relationship to prayer. And we made them do a bit of Simone Weil at the start of the year. But we used that as a kicking off point to think about what it means to pay attention to things, not to get them right, but that the attention in and of itself is a good thing. And that's developing something useful and spiritual within us. And so we did some work with them around prayer, attention, and academic study, and trying to enable them to start to see academic study as part of their prayer life. I wouldn't say it was like super successful, but it had some success. I have a PhD student who prays before he starts his PhD study each day. We use the Thomas Aquinas' prayer for students, which I just love. We gave that to our students as ways of encouraging them to see that when they're sitting down to study, this is part of their worship. It's part of their prayer. It's feeding them in the same way that their prayer in chapel is supposed to be feeding them.
Totally.
It's hard. I get it. I totally get it. And I would say, you know, there were days in my PhD and there are days now where I'm like, I am getting nothing from this. This is dry as you like.
Or it's like really frustrating.
Yeah.
That also happens.
Or it seems totally contrary to like what it is that I'm actually kind of feeling I'm called to do. But yeah, I think we've tried to kind of recognize and address that and repeatedly address it. But I'm lucky in Westcott's context in that I think I have a number of colleagues who are like research active and would talk about their research and their own spiritual lives as being deeply entwined. And that we're trying to make that the kind of culture here. But it's hard, right? Especially for ordinands who are studying and their own placements and they're doing like a formational track. Like, you know, they're real busy. It's easy to not see this as a gift. And that's okay as well, I think. Just kind of bring them back to the idea that the things we pay attention to cultivate an attitude of prayer within us. You know, it doesn't matter how good the grades are. It's the attention itself that is the gift.
I was just on retreat with some of our students at Holy Cross Monastery, and we spent a couple of days in silence together at the beginning of Lent. And this was precisely the subject of our conversation. How do we integrate into the head and the heart? How do we cultivate a kind of attentiveness when most of the time we're actually distracted? Attention really is the mother of almost every other activity, right?
Yeah.
And so if we don't know how to be awake and alert, right? This was Jesus' invitation the night before he died. Stay awake with me, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to hear that it's sort of foundational for y'all. And, you know, those are seeds that you plant that, you know, you may not see germinating now, but I've got to believe that many will have that light bulb moment. Oh, that's what Karen was talking about. Oh, I get it now.
Yeah, I hope so. Also, kind of this idea that they're not finished when they leave here, that they're in. So there's two things with that. Firstly, that we would encourage them to continue to think of themselves as theologians as they move forward into ministry and try to use that language in our classrooms of referring to our students as theologians. But the other part of that is that we try and use language in the college of all of us as staff as well, being in formation.
Mm.
So we talk about students being on a program of formation, but I will also talk about myself as being formed by the classes I teach and by the time I spend in chapel. And it's helpful to see all of us on a kind of movement together, that we're not these kind of finished products that are trying to churn out other finished products.
Yes.
Yeah. Love it.
Oh, I need to ask you about this class that you're teaching where you're doing different prayer practices. How's that going? Do you have anything to tell us?
Yeah, it's not a class actually. So we have a tutorial system here in Westcott House where each student is assigned a tutor, and our tutor groups, so I have about six in my tutor group, we meet together during the week, and you know, we're a small community, so we see plenty of each other, but we intentionally, all the tutor groups meet together on a Friday morning after morning prayer, and we have breakfast together. And so we take it in turns to provide breakfast. Students do it, I do it, and what we're supposed to do is just have various conversations. So I've been here for a year and a half, and the first year in a term, you know, students signed up to lead conversations, and you know, we talk about All Saints kind of at the end of October, and you know, we talk about our favorite saints or spiritual practices that help us grow, or you know, if we'd organized the Eucharist previously, kind of reflecting on how that gone, or you know, what's your favorite book, you know, different topics. But just at the end of the Michaelmas term, just before Christmas, my tutor group decided that they wanted to be a bit more intentional about what we were doing on our Friday mornings. And I used to lead a master's degree program in Christian spirituality. So what they said was, we want to focus on different spiritual practices. And I was like, cool, what do you want to do? So we brainstormed like a massive list of things, and I just allocated them to the weeks that were left of Lent term and Easter term. And so we have been experimenting. So we've done the Jesus Prayer. Big hit. Everybody's a big fan of that. Which is interesting. Like, everybody had done it before. We talk about it on the Friday morning, and then we intentionally do it for a week.
Okay.
And then we check back in the next Friday, and then the next student teaches us the next practice, and then we go off and do that. So we've done the Jesus Prayer, we've done how to use rosaries, daily offices, which we pray morning and evening prayer anyway. But what we ended up doing was we discovered that we loved the midday prayer in common worship. And so we have, as a tutor group, added in midday prayer. So we meet together to pray in the middle of the day, which is amazing. This week we've been using the Examen, which is been fantastic. We had a fantastic week a couple of weeks ago where we used Cole Arthur Riley's Black Liturgies book, the new book that's just come out.
Yeah.
And I photocopied them a kind of morning office that we had to use for the week. And they loved it so much, they did a bulk order and all ordered the book. And then they've been using them in intercessions in morning and evening prayer in the chapel. We've used them for praying on Ash Wednesday. Her Ash Wednesday meditation was amazing. Mm-hmm. interestingly, it's brought us really close as a group, which is weird because, like, technically we're not really doing anything much more different than we were doing before. But yeah, it's been amazing. And we're only kind of not even halfway through. We've got another 2 weeks of term left.
I mean, it's a different level of depth and human connection than just talking about a book or something like that.
Yeah.
Not just talking about a book. I love to talk about books. But Rowan Williams in his episode also talked a lot about the Jesus Prayer. And I didn't share this story at that point.
Come to you, Hannah. Tell us.
I have like my own experience of the Jesus Prayer. And I almost responded to you on Twitter, X or whatever, with this story. And I was like, this is a little too wild for the internet. So now I guess I'll share it with the internet.
Yeah, on the internet, yeah.
I used to have a job as a performer at Disneyland. And one of my roles was so stressful to me because I, since the time I was a toddler, have been afraid of fireworks. And in this dancing role, I had to jump straight into fireworks that were coming at me. Because it's supposed to look like I came out of thin air, obviously. So I had to do this night after night, twice a night for my job. And I was so afraid of it that, like, as I was waiting, I would be like doing breathing exercises with the Jesus Prayer.
Amazing.
Fully costumed. With, like, the music amping up behind me going, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the Living God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the Living God, sinner. I have yet to like discern whether this is a good or a bad thing. But now, like when my heart rate gets really high and I can feel stress in my body, the words start just happening.
Oh wow!
Like I feel like maybe that shouldn't always be a stress response. Like maybe I should pray those words also when I'm not feeling like I'm about to die. But
this was what the group was saying. Was like when we talked about the Jesus Prayer, everybody was like, "Yes, I've used it in times of great anxiety." Somebody was like, "I get very frightened going to the dentist, and it's my meditation at the dentist." And so, what was fun was doing this attention. One of the ways I ended up using it was if I get to chapel 2-3 minutes early, I've got a kind of set of prayer beads I keep in my pocket, and just do like I just keep doing it until the prayer, starts. Yeah, and I've taken to carry the prayer beads in my pocket. So every time I put my hand in my pocket, I catch on it. I'm just starting to do it. And yeah, because I'd only ever really used it as a like panic attack medication type thing. Which I don't think Jesus minds. Like I think
I was gonna
right
say, I'll look forward to the heavenly conversation where we really hash that out.
Absolutely. Jesus is like, well, is that the best way of praying? I don't mind. It's fine.
I mean, better to pray than not to pray.
Exactly.
I guess.
Well, this is maybe a great transition to trauma, because that sounded terrifying to me, Hannah. And
to be clear, I wouldn't name that as traumatic.
It's the best part of the podcasting with you. I get to learn things about you. And not surprisingly, it's also true for me. I detest fireworks. Oh, I mean, the 4th of July is the low point in the year. But there's been so much conversation in, you know, the last generation or two about the pervasiveness of trauma in our world. And thankfully, so much more awareness and so much more compassion and sensitivity. And I just wonder how you became interested in trauma and speak a little bit about what you're finding at the intersection of trauma and theology.
Yeah.
It's everywhere, I suspect.
Right. I became interested in trauma theology by accident, as all the best academic career moves happen.
Yep.
My PhD supervisor, one of them was Siobhan Garrigan, and she happened to mention some writing by her friend Serene Jones on trauma. And I was like, that sounds cool. So I went and kind of tracked it down. And what I found was Serene Jones's 2001 article in Modern Theology, which is called Hope Deferred, and is about pregnancy loss and infertility. And she writes out of her own experience of miscarrying and of pastoring those who have miscarried as well. I'd never read anything like it. Siobhan had no idea that I had had a number of miscarriages. Yeah. To this day, don't even know if that's the piece of work she was meaning to talk about when she said Serene Jones. But I read it and I was supposed to be writing a book review of something for Siobhan. And I, like a week later, I came back and I said, I think I've overstepped. And I gave her what I'd written. And I basically, I'd like started this book review and then grown some trauma legs quite quickly. And like, just run with it. And Siobhan was like, this is what you should be doing your PhD on. And she was quite right. Hmm. So I did like a bit of a crash course. There wasn't much. So took in like over a decade ago now. pretty sure I read almost everything written in trauma theology within the 3 years. The field was so small that you could kind of count the major publications on two hands. Like, I can't keep up with it now, and that's amazing. So, like, I have PhD students working in trauma, and they're, like, referencing books. I'm like, I've not heard of this one. This is so cool. It's the only way I keep up to date with the reading. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it. For me, trauma theology and feminist theology, they're obviously not the same thing, but for me, they kind of sing out of the same hymn sheet in that they're both interested in taking the experience of our bodies seriously, accounting for or taking notice of the way in which that the experiences of our body shape the kinds of theologies that we are able to write and also able to affirm as well. And so there's a kind of natural connection. In fact, Katie Cross and I edited a book a few years ago called Feminist Trauma Theologies. Hmm. We were trying to make that connection quite explicit. Interestingly, Shelley Rambo wrote the foreword for that, where she talks about, she was Serene Jones's PhD student, and she talks about how obviously it was feminist because we were all feminists, but we never like called it feminist. It was just, we were the people doing it. And so it has this kind of feminist root, feminist legacy that has blossomed and flourished in lots of really interesting ways. And church needs to become trauma-informed. And to do that, it needs good trauma-informed theologies. And it needs pastors and priests that are trauma-informed and understand what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about trauma.
One of the reasons I was really excited when I saw you were launching this Feminist Theology Network is because, in sort of a lone wolf kind of a way, I had done my due diligence literature review of feminist theology, blah, blah, whatever. And just kind of noticed on my own that theology calling itself feminist theology has like trickled away.
Right.
But yeah. It seems to me, and what you're saying about these observations kind of tracks with my hypothesis, which is that like it's dovetailed into trauma theology in a really significant way. And our usage of the word feminist has changed a lot since the 80s and 90s. So that's significant too.
Yeah. It's one of the things I found really interesting is that feminist theology is now having another moment.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually, it's kind of in the ascendancy. Again, people are excited about what it might mean.
Yeah.
People are hungry for finding out more about it. And that's like people of all generations. So it's not just kind of people that, you know, missed out on the kind of flourishing stuff of the 90s. And I think part of that is maybe it's kind of post-economic crash 2008 onwards. There's the kind of resurgence of tradwife kind of culture. And And I think that part of that's to do with the internet and kind of making these things kind of really popular and accessible to people.
I also think part of it is looking in the mirror and realizing actually things in church life and home lives haven't changed. Like all this amazing work has been done. But when we look at our friends, our families, our churches, like the cash out hasn't quite been accomplished.
This is it. So I was asked recently to write a survey of feminist theology for... There's a new volume of Ford's Modern Theologians coming out, and I felt the weight of that request like super heavy on me.
Wow.
But one of the kind of sections that I was kind of told that I had to kind of write about was the influence, achievement, and future agenda of feminist theology. And I was okay. But what I actually ended up doing was looking at an edited collection from 1990 that was written by Anne Lodes.
Yeah.
And she wrote in the kind of foreword about the situation of feminist theology in 1990. And as I read it, I thought that's still exactly the same today.
Yeah, that's it.
Talks about like the Christian tradition is still fundamentally ambivalent for women. Christianity still offers women really unhelpful gender construction. Mm-hmm. The male related symbol and metaphor is still given priority.
Mm-hmm.
We still need to do better at attending to experiences of difference in class and ethnicity.
Yep.
Like that's still the same.
Well, the way I see it, and this may be different from the way you see it, and actually I have some things I can email to you and share with you so we can keep talking this offline. But the way I see it is some really important, incisive critiques have been made by people like Rita Nakashima Brock. But that was difficult work that was done. And at the same time, it's easier to critique something than to build something new. And so we're in a stage now, I think, where the projects we have to undertake are telling the stories in fresh ways. And actually, this does bring me to kenosis and atonement and things like that.
Yeah.
Do you have any words of wisdom for people wanting to parse out what is kenosis? How do I interpret that well? What is atonement? How do I interpret that well? Those kinds of issues.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, kenosis. Okay.
Yeah.
I've got no truck with it whatsoever. So self-emptying, self-giving, self-sacrificing. Women are socialized to do those things, especially in familial contexts, but also in academic contexts, also in business contexts and work context. And I just don't think that feminist theology can endorse at least a traditional version of kenotic theology. And I think traditionally theology's done a really bad job at saying this is what it means to be like Christ. So like, Jesus' suffering was redemptive. Fine. You might like to argue that. You don't have to argue it. I'm increasingly not on board with the idea of redemptive suffering. But the problem comes when that kind of particular suffering then is writ large to imply that all suffering is redemptive, and that what it means to follow Christ is to be engaged in that form of suffering. And I'm not a big fan of Paul, really, Saint Paul. No, he talks a lot about the life of the Christian is one of Christ-like suffering and self-denial. Fine, but that's like one day of Jesus's life, right? The passion. But I'm also interested in Jesus's life and ministry. I think we can be Christ-like in lots of ways. We can be Christ-like in hospitality and welcome and joyfulness and abundance and excess and hanging out with our friends. And I've been massively inspired in the last year or so. I've been reading again Lisa Isherwood's Fat Jesus. And just this beautiful image of an abundant Christology where, yes, Jesus suffers and he bears his suffering in a particular way, but he also is full of joy and he's also the person that transforms water into wine and hangs out and eats fish on a beach with his friend. I think we get into trouble when we say to be Christ-like is to do this thing.
Hmm.
I heard Kelly Brown Douglas speak. We were really fortunate that she came to Westcott earlier this year. And she just made this tiny little point about how in the creed, we say he was born and then he suffered and died. Ugh. And we skip 30 years. And I'm like, oh, and they're the best bit, right? Like they're challenging, but they are just as much part of what it means to be Christ-like as the other bits. All super important. I'm not devaluing those. But what I get frustrated about is that, yes, Jesus Christ is kenotic. And yet, that doesn't mean that he spends all 33 or however many years of his life in suffering and self-denial. You know, he has a good time along the way. And like, we need a bigger vision of what it means to be Christ-like.
Yeah.
Because if we're going to say to be Christ-like is about self-denial and suffering, and it's God of Gethsemane through to the, you know, resurrection, we're doing ourselves a disservice, but we're doing the incarnate God a disservice as well. That's too small a vision for me. Sorry, I got really excited there. I got in preaching mode.
No, and your excitement actually led me to want to zoom out actually and ask a big question. So, I'm a father of daughters, both of whom are just around 20, and they're strong women and they're deeply rooted feminists. And they're not so sure about the church.
Yeah.
Because they haven't been in your classroom, Karen. And and they've been in parishes that, you know, we're all too familiar and all too patriarchal. And they're wondering, you know, is there a space for me anywhere in this tradition?
Yeah.
And of course, when Dad sort of describes conversations like we're having today, and when I, you know, roll out my litany of feminist theologians and saints and mentors, they're not so sure. And so I wonder, so here's a tall order, you know, speaking to, you know, a 20-year-old who's open, who's curious.
Yeah.
But who's at a moment of decision, like, am I going to embrace this, you know, in my adult life? How do you speak to them? What do you talk to them about? What stories do you tell to awaken their imagination?
Gosh, that's really hard. You can be what you can see, right? So I think if you want women to be making choices to be in churches, then they need to be encountering parts of the church where there are women who are like them. Do you know what I have found? Don't laugh. Don't judge me. I have found TikTok to be an amazing experience.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I've encountered so many women priests on TikTok that have filled me with joy and brought me closer to God. Like I'm just, I don't have enough of them in my life. And I have encountered them. Like you say what you like about social media and a lot of it is absolute toxic hell. But Oh my goodness, there are some amazing women, and particularly women priests, who have just like really blessed me. And you know, I'm in a tradition where, you know, we do ordain women, but largely nothing has changed, and the masculine patriarchal structures of what it means to be a priest are still very much in place. But I think for me, part of the journey has been not just seeing, you know, great priests on kind of social media, which is fab, but discovering the women in the tradition for myself. I discovered the Beguines a few years ago, and you know, they are amazing. I've discovered Haddowitch, and she was bonkers, and I loved Marjorie Kemp. Oh, I love Marjorie. You know, I just like, oh, she's full of emotion, and she's loud, and she's messy and leaky. And Julian says, this is from God. And like, oh, I love it. Yeah, you can only be what you can see. And one of the things I think feminist theology needs to do is to be more active in dismantling the structures of patriarchy. I think we've pointed out the flaws, but actually we need to be advocating and enabling change to happen. I don't have a kind of recipe of what that change would look like,
right?
But it can't look the way it currently is, because why then would any young person of any gender want particularly to join the church, right? They're the declining group. But I'm challenged by, I read last year Abby Day's work on the religious lives of older Anglican lay women, which is quite a mouthful of a title, but she basically spent 2 years hanging out in parish churches with older Anglican lay women. So they were in their late 70s upwards, and discovering what their spirituality looked like. Oh, it's incredible. These women are in our churches. They're the reason the churches are still going. We have not done justice to women in our church yet.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we do it, but I want to be doing it.
I love it. Well, we've been talking for longer than it seems like we've been talking for. So I wonder if we can ask you one final question that we do really like to make practice of asking people, which is, what is giving you hope right now?
Oh, okay. The Feminist Theology Network has given me hope.
Oh, amen.
Oh, it's. Well,
can you share a little bit about what that is?
Yeah. So,
oh, good idea.
I was lying on a sun lounger in Lanzarote, and I had had a number of people previously. I was like, you know, when you're finally on vacation, like all the conversations you've had like start to make sense in your head. I had like a couple of PhD students, and then a couple of like women vicars who I was friends with, just be like, oh, where would I go in the UK or anywhere really to like meet other feminist theologians and find out about what's happening? And I was like, huh, I don't know. And if I don't know, that probably means it isn't that. So I thought I'll just start something. And so basically it's an informal gathering of people who are interested in feminist theology. So of all genders, it's around the world.
All occupations.
All kinds of occupations. It's not just academics, not just clergy, all kinds of people involved in it. And the last few months, we've been gathering every couple of months to listen to a speaker, to ask some questions, to find out more about different types of feminist theology, and to spend some time together. It's the one Zoom thing that I've been to where people are like, the breakout groups are amazing. Not the bit that everyone's like, oh no, not the breakout groups. When people are like, oh, I got to meet so many cool people and I wish we'd had more time. So that's fantastic. So that's the kind of starting point. We're hoping to launch a mentoring scheme later on in the year. I'm hoping that we will have a summer kind of event on pregnancy and theology, because that's when the book will come out and I could have some of my amazing contributors give little papers. Hannah's organizing something on feminist and queer homiletics in September, which is going to be so cool. I'm really looking forward to that. So that's what it is. But the best thing about it is that we have a WhatsApp community, which anyone can join. And it's pretty lively. People asking for book recommendations, people kind of making plans as kind of like local groups, kind of making plans to meet up, sharing events. It's just been really great. So that's giving me hope. If I can add two more things to this, things that are giving me hope. The new generation of ordinands that I'm teaching gives me hope that the church will be better. And that's a good thing. The other thing that I found here, although I work at Westcott House, we are part of what's called the Cambridge Theological Federation. And I also teach in the Divinity Faculty at Cambridge University. And one of the things I found to be really life-giving is working with colleagues who are deeply committed to theological education. Oh, I'm a teacher at heart. That's my vocation. And I just find that to be really life-giving and makes me hopeful for the future of theology.
Well, thank you so, so, so much for spending time with us.
That's a pleasure.
Such a sparkle joy in my week. And I'm really excited to share this with our listeners.
Thank you. Me too.
An absolute blessing, Karen. Thank you so much for all your work. You go with our prayers and our hope that we can meet someday in person. I hope our paths cross.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Thank you for listening to The Leader's Way. We hope you were encouraged and inspired. To learn more about this episode, visit our website at berkeleydivinity.yale.edu/podcast.
Rate and review us and follow the podcast to make sure you never miss an episode. Follow Berkeley at Yale on Instagram for quotes from the podcast and more.
Until next time.
The Lord be with you.